Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog. Sorry about the slight delay there. I had a little bit of technical difficulties. But tonight we have a really awesome guest. And before we get into talking to him about all of his projects and everything like that, we got to do all of our plugs like always. So make sure to go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. If you like what we do, you want to support what we do, keep the lights on, go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And you can get the RSS feed and get the audio of every single show that we do, so you can listen to on your commutes, in your car, at the gym, or at work at patreon.com/thebog. If you support the bog another way, make sure to go to spreadshirt.com/bogshop. And let me tell you, the esoteric order of grill dads is alive. We have revealed ourselves. If you want to get yourself some really awesome bog merch, like an artisan chef apron or a muscle shirt to show off your guns when the sun's out, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. Support us there. And if you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. This stuff is so cool. You guys saw Neil John over on our episode a few weeks ago. The guy's brilliant. The stuff's brilliant. So if you want to go check him out, go to facebook.com/ironagejodish. If you decide to get a chart and hire Mr. Neil John, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. But tonight, we got Mr. Andre from Norway's with us. He's co-hosting. And then everybody's favorite, we have Dan Kapp, Volk from Vulcansman. We have a real live rock star on tonight. Mr. Dan, how you doing tonight?
I'm good, thanks, Dave. Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, sir. So you are one of my most requested guests. I'm going to tell you right now. Everybody says, oh, get the guy from Vulcansman, get Vulcansman. Your music is so special to so many heathens, it's unreal. You know, like we said, I told you, there was a little story. One of my chats, I had a guy, he posted a picture. He said, these are my most prized possessions. These are my most prized heathen possessions that I have. And he had like an effigy to the gods. He had a statue. He had like some few other things, some trinkets, some runes and stuff like that. He actually had a copy of the Epicis magazine that we put out from Neurona Society, Epicis number 3. And he had the vinyl of one of your albums. It was like the red one. It had the red on the front. So your music is very special to a lot of people.
Wow. I mean, that's really humbling. When you told me that, it's very humbling to hear things like that.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And so what we're going to get into tonight is I want to ask you about your spiritual journey, because you are a heathen like me and Andre and all of us here in the bog and all the bog lords out there. And then also, being a musician myself, I want to talk to you about how you got into music, all the nuts and bolts of your project of Vulcansman, and maybe even talk a little bit about your other project, Fyrgin, right? That's how you say it, Fyrgin. So we're going to talk about all that kind of stuff. So let's get started with your spiritual journey. How did you become a heathen? How did you come to heathenry? And are you a second generation? Or give us your story there.
Okay, it was a pretty convoluted path. I was born into a non-religious family. My father's English. My mother is Dutch. I was christened, but only really because my cousin, who's about the same age as me, was christened. And my parents decided to kind of double up on the whole ceremony with my uncle and auntie. So I kind of, even though my family were non-religious, I kind of grew up sort of considering myself a Christian, because I was very close with my cousin whose family were Christian. So there was this kind of bond there. But then I did the kind of typical thing where when I hit my teens, you know, I found atheism, so to speak.
Oh yeah.
You know, like most people do, you know, it's cool to be an atheist, especially, you know, when you're from sort of our generation. But I'd always, at the back of my mind, I'd always been fascinated by the paranormal. By anything supernatural had always fascinated me since I was a young child. Ghost stories, you know, crazy stuff like, what do you call it? Spontaneous combustion and, the Bermuda Triangle and yeah. You know, anything like that really, really interested me. So after kind of considering myself an atheist, I started to kind of look at what else there could be to kind of to investigate, really. I then found, and this will probably ties into what we'll talk about in a bit, but I then discovered metal, specifically black metal. And, you know, firstly, I came across bands like Burzum, who, you know, Varg Vikernes from Burzum always had a very, certainly since the third album, had a strong kind of Germanic heathen aspect to the themes of the album. Lots of use of runes on the CDs and things, and T-shirts. So that kind of was the first was one of the first times I'd ever been really introduced to heathenry there. Even though at school, I remember, it's funny, a couple of years ago, I found an old school project I did where I'd probably been about 9 or 10 years old, and I'd apparently I'd chosen to do a topic on the Anglo-Saxons and the runes and the gods, which I'd kind of, you know, had kind of been blanked from my memory until my mum found the old kind of project hidden away in a box somewhere.
So cool.
But yeah, when I was in my teens and I found metal, and so I kind of had a sort of flirtation with a short flirtation with heathenry then. But then I discovered bands like a band which was quite inspirational spiritually in a really strange way, was a band called Dissection from Sweden.
Yeah, I know Dissection.
Yeah. So I'm a huge, huge fan of Dissection. But when John Nodvate came out of prison, he came out, for those of you who don't know much about Dissection, the main guy from that band, he went to prison for murder. And when he came out a diehard Gnostic Luciferian. So not just a normal Satanist, but this whole idea that the material realm is ruled by the Judeo-Christian Jehovah, and that the true God, you know, beyond the cosmic realm is Lucifer. And this whole idea really, really fascinated me, this kind of Gnostic idea. And I spent a while looking into that whole thing.
Real quick, what's your favorite Dissection album? I'm sorry. What's your favorite Dissection album?
Storm of the Lightsbane.
Oh, yeah. That's the best one. Okay. Sorry, I just had to bring that up because there's a lot of debate over those albums. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's the one for me. I mean, it's Sumberlain's a close second, but that's
Reign Chaos is garbage. He should have just stayed in jail.
you know what? Controversial, but I like it, but it is like a different band. It sounds like a different band.
It's like rock or something. It's not even black metal anymore. It's like a blackened rock band or something. Anti-cosmic rock.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so I'd looked into this kind of Gnostic Luciferian thing briefly. This was all just kind of like a process of expanding my awareness of what different paths there were out there. I was probably at this time, I was probably about, 16, 17 years old at that point, something like that. Or maybe a little bit older, a couple of years older. I can't remember when he came out of prison. But then after that, I met a guy who across the internet who was like a kind of modern day shaman. But he was very much, even though he was like I think he was a Canadian guy, but he was very much into the kind of Shinto Japanese thing. Mm-hmm. And we corresponded a bit over email and things, and he opened my eyes up to that whole world of shamanism and kind of this animistic view of the world, where everything, you know, from the kind of, you know, the stones that you walk upon to your car has a spirit of its own. So I bought a couple of books actually on Celtic shamanism. I don't know why Celtic. I guess partly because at that point, I was kind of looking for my identity and things. And, you know, when you're from Britain, you're often told that your identity is Celtic. Mm-hmm. I read these books and started to try and practice these kind of this kind of journeying in a shamanistic aspect, I really got a lot out of that. I mean, they say that the first kind of meditative journey that you do is always your most kind of powerful one, and that was certainly the case for me. And that really opened my eyes to this idea that there was this whole spirit world, really. And then from there on, I kind of began looking more into my identity and, realized that actually, the path that I should be following, the path of my ancestors, was really an old English one, an Anglo-Saxon one. So then I started to read. Actually, it was a book. One of the most important books for me was a book called The Real Middle Earth by Brian Bates, who also wrote a book called The Way of Weird, which most of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with. It's a really good fictional story of an Anglo-Saxon shaman, essentially. But built into the story is lots of the cited lore from old English texts like the Laknunga and all the kind of aspects of that we know about the lots of things that were adopted by Tolkien in his works. Mm-hmm. The sources of all of those things were kind of drawn upon for The Way of Weird, and that really brought this old kind of this mystical old England to life for me. And it felt like a real place that I just knew instinctively existed, and was something that I was connected to ancestrally, and then it's just been a process of kind of active study from then on, really. I've reading books by the likes of Swain Wodening and Stephen Pollington, just learning more about learning specifically about the Anglo-Frisian runes. Because as I'm sure you and your listeners know, there are more Anglo runes than there are Elder Futhark or Younger Futhark ones.
Yeah.
And some of those aspects of the additional runes are things that I've pulled into the Walkinsman music lyrically and thematically. That's pretty much it. I mean, I had a couple of kind of mystical experiences, which they're kind of long stories, so I won't go into them, but I've always had a very kind of empirical mind, and I've always needed to have proof of anything. I don't blindly believe things, or I didn't, because I've always needed to see, a kind of empirical proof for something, that something is real. And it wasn't until I had a couple of experiences that I had this real kind of confirmation that, yeah, there absolutely is, that the gods are real, and that there is this spirit realm, and that there are all these kind of different forces, these hidden forces at play in our material lives.
That's fascinating, man. It's there's so, I can't tell you how many, especially in art, I'm guessing you're about my age. You're an older millennial, right? Probably in your early 30s, late 20s or something like that. So
I'm 37.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad I look, glad I look younger than I am. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, I guess that was that young Gen X, similar age group, right? So
I think I'm an old millennial. Yeah. Just about.
Those of us that are in millennials are all in our 30s now, right? Jeez, we're getting dang. So anyway, there's this commonality, this reoccurring theme that I hear, and it's an experience that was very similar for me and a lot of folks our age. I talk to guys that have this very similar experience. We start out, from a kind of like a half, my family was half-ass Catholic. My dad is like a nothing, and then my mom is like, says all the things that virtue signals about being Catholic, but probably has never read the Bible. She never goes to church. You know, she's like, you know, half-ass Catholic. So I was raised half-ass Catholic, this insincere Catholicism. And then I rejected it as I got a little bit older, and I put on my fedora, and I became an atheist and started reading Richard Dawkins and thought I was cool. And then from there, around this time, I started getting into extreme metal, and I got into stuff like Dissection, stuff like, I just got into, I loved King Diamond and like all this kind of stuff. And then I got further along and I got into like Church of Satan and I was listening to too much Behemoth, and I got into that kind of stuff, right? But that was very, very short because it was very unfulfilling, and I had some run-ins with some people that were actually serious about those paths, and they were really weird people. And I was like, I'm not a weird guy like this, you know what I mean? So I went further on and I got into heathenry, and I've always had an affinity for the myth. And as you said about Tolkien and some of the fiction stuff, man, the fiction stuff was so important for me to actually be able to visualize. You said a magic England or a mystical England. For me, it's the same kind of thing. Obviously, I'm from the States, but it's the same kind of thing. I was able to visualize these things. I was able, when I read Conan the Barbarian, I was able to visualize people that believed in polytheism, right? It wasn't just some sort of historical document, some just like attestation of some historical thing. It was like, it felt like real living characters that jumped off the page and actually believed these things. So it was like, it kind of made it real for me. And then further along, I started feeling some kind of way. I met my wife, and I was already sort of into this and kind of stuff like that. But as a teenager, even then, like I remember one of my friends hit me up a while ago, and he's like, "Oh man, you're all into this this heathen stuff now. You're like, I've been watching your show. Remember when we were like 16 and we dumped beer on the fire for Odin?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, I completely forgot about that. We were like doing these like really kind of, we didn't know what we were doing, but we had this drive as teenagers to get into it." So it was like the fiction, the music, all of these different things. And then I came across Stephen McNallan on YouTube. This is back in like the early days of YouTube. And I got into the community, so on and so forth, all else is history. And then plus I had really powerful spiritual experiences that confirmed it in my mind. And I was like, you know what? This is true. You know what I mean? Because I don't think it's just like a personality type to be an empirical thinker or to be a rational person. I just think in modernity, we are very much raised on that scientific mind, right? We are the scientific process. Everything must be literal and material and empirical and stuff like that. So we're raised to have that worldview. So we have to kind of, I don't want to say unlearn, because it's still, you know, I make fun of science and stuff a lot, but really the truth is they're important. It's important to have scientific processes and stuff like that, but we have to sort of unlearn that as our base worldview before we go on. So Mr. Andre, do you have anything to chime in on?
Well, we have a question from the chat here.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Rudolf's Artisanal Soap and Lampshade Emporium asks, do you think the added runes were merely for accommodating the West Germanic languages, or are there more esoteric reasons for it?
Is that for me to answer?
I believe it is so.
I think I'm aware of both arguments. I would rather believe the latter because it's less mundane. Because there's this, we have the, we have the Kalk and the Stan and the Quaoth runes and the Gar runes. So these are like the four hallows. Which, you know, a lot of people believe tie into the kind of Arthurian mythos. So that's something which I've drawn on quite heavily, particularly for the last Balkansman album, Fire in the White Stone. You know, the whole idea of the White Stone, which is depicted on the cover of the album, that's the chalice, the kalk or kalch, the chalk, the White Stone. So I drew quite heavily on that kind of the Hallows Arthurian aspect of those additional runes, but I do accept that they could well have. But, you know, maybe it's both. Maybe the answer is both. You know, I think usually usually I think the answer to most questions is that it serves all functions at the same time, you know. I think it's I couldn't say for sure. I mean, no one can say for sure which is the absolute reason why we have these additional runes. We can only really speculate. I don't know. Have you guys got any thoughts on that?
I don't know anything about the Saxon runes or anything. I pretty much only focus on the Elder Futhark, and I'm not really like much of a rune guy. Like I learn what they mean as far as their Eddic meanings, and I can read English script in Elder Futhark, but I don't really go too far because a lot of runic, like how many books have been written about runes? Like umpteen thousand books, and there's only really three sources that talk about runes, right? That talk about their meaning outside of just being a basic script. So a lot of it is speculative. So me personally, I don't go too far into the rune stuff.
Yeah,
same thing with me. Honestly, I don't necessarily believe that the runes are entirely mundane, but I don't simultaneously believe that they are also like not esoteric in some context. I think the context of how runes are used and how they're read and seen and so forth are almost as important as the runes themselves.
Yeah, I mean, in the Anglo-Frisian runes, you know, we have the Gar rune, which looks like a Gifu rune, but with an additional kind of diamond in the middle. And a vertical line as well. That's the Kalk rune. The Gar rune's just got the diamond in the middle. So, you know, that in terms of language, linguistically, that serves the same purpose as the Gifu rune. So in the case of that rune, for example, I'd have to assume really that that's there for esoteric reasons as opposed to linguistic ones. It's difficult to say. I mean, I think there is a very strong case to be made for the idea that these additional runes are mythical or esoteric as opposed to purely practical, the additional ones.
So here's kind of my take on it. And Mr. Dan, I'd like to hear your opinion about it. This is, you know, it's not written anywhere. This is just my gnosis. I think that a lot of times when we talk about things that are esoteric or things that are magic, we overemphasize or we blow them up a little too much. And a lot of times I believe that magic is very practical and we see magic every day. So when I went in Voluspa, when Odin says, do you know how to write them? Like, do you know how to write the runes? And when he's talking about the runes and stuff like that, and when we're talking about the magic of the runes, this is my gnosis, that the ability to write and record things is the magic, that the runes being able to be used as a script is the magic. That's my opinion.
It's like this whole idea that Hollywood is derived from the druidic druidic wands that were made from the holly tree, and that Hollywood is just a modern manifestation of the same kind of current of magic that was being used in druidic times. So, you know, we in our modern age, we can look at something like the films that come out of Hollywood and think that they're actually kind of quite material and mundane, and that there's nothing magical in the sense that we've been brought up to believe magic is about those films. But actually, when you really look at the effects that those films have on the wider culture, and therefore on the folk as a whole, it kind of seems mundane on the surface of it, but the ability to affect the minds and behaviors of a large mass of people,
that is the magic.
At the same time, that is magic. Yeah.
I say often when we talk about like occultism and black magic and domination magic and like, all this kind of stuff, the most powerful magicians in the world wouldn't even know what occultism means. They know nothing about black magic, but they are the most powerful magicians. They don't call it magic. They call it marketing strategies, and they don't wear black robes. They wear two-piece suits and carry a briefcase. you know, when we talk about when we get into like marketing strategies and all of the stuff that they do, product placement and all that, is magic. That is magic. This is what our ancestors were talking about. When we think about magic, we think about Merlin or Gandalf throwing a fireball or Dungeons and Dragons. That's not necessarily magic. You know, magic to our ancestors was a much more practical thing, and it's anything that affects that, like using metaphysical means to affect the physical. Well, what do you think about that, Mr. Dan?
I agree. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think that those kind of marketing gurus who just have a like an aptitude for that kind of thing, those of them who can also pair that with kind of you know, looking at the kind of astrological aspects and to time their actions in a certain way, they can enhance the power of what they do. So I do think that those, you know, you say that those kind of powerful modern magicians wouldn't even know what the occult is. I think that's true, but I think the ones that do know what the occult is are even more powerful, but they're also more clandestine.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. So, Mr. Dan, let's segue a little bit into some of your music stuff. What do you think about that?
Okay.
So,
yeah, let's do it.
So everybody knows you for Vulcansman and the albums that you've put. I believe I saw you have 6 albums, right? Is that, you have 6 albums with that project?
No, I've got that. There's the demo, or as I've now called it, the early recordings, because I re-released it with some kind of compilation tracks. Mm-hmm. And that kind of constitutes an album, I guess. And then the first proper album is Songs from the Fergan. And then after that, I did an EP called Songs from the Mere. And then after that was Fire in the White Stone. So technically it's 2 full-length albums and kind of 2 EPs. But I guess they're kind of long EPs. So it's 4 releases that I've done.
And what led you up to Vulcansman? Because you said that earlier that you started out with metal. You're a metal guy. So did you have any bands that you played in or metal projects leading up to this?
I mean, in 2007, I made my first black metal album under the name Spearling. And that was just a homage to all of my favorite kind of 90s Norwegian black metal bands, really. But the thing is that those of you out there who know anything about black metal know that there's a strong connection with kind of neo folk or neoclassical. So, for example, you had the pretty groundbreaking Norwegian band Ulver. They made second album, in fact, was a fully acoustic neoclassical album called Kveldsanger. And that was a huge influence on me. I think that came out, I think it was, I'm going to stab and take a stab at 96 that came out. And I first heard that in my, sort of mid to late teens. So probably a couple of years after it came out, and it was a huge influence on me because it had this kind of really palpable, Nordic atmosphere to it, this very, very kind of thick kind of nighttime foresty woodland ancient sounding atmosphere to it, and that really grabbed me. And it struck me that this was creating the same atmosphere that a lot of my favorite black metal bands were creating, but in a completely different form. So rather than using distorted guitars and you know, blast beats and things on the drums, it was using just, you know, a couple of classical guitars and some kind of choir vocals. So that had a big impact on me. Also, you know, I was always a huge fan of Bathory. And on my favorite Bathory album is Blood on Ice, and on that album there's a song called Man of Iron, which is a fully acoustic song. It's just Quorthon of Bathory and a guitar, and that song always struck me as having that same kind of you know, again, the same sort of atmosphere that the rest of the Bathory stuff had, but in an acoustic form. And then I was also a fan of the early Opeth albums, And a lot of their songs have these big kind of expansive acoustic sections and interludes and things within the songs. So kind of from the beginning of my time with extreme metal, I was very aware of this strong kind of acoustic folk neoclassical undercurrent within it. Mm-hmm. And you know, fast forward, I guess, like, I mean, I started the Wolkensmann project in 2013. So I guess, I was like kind of 29, 30 when I started it. So yeah, kind of 10 to 12 years later, after I'd first discovered these acoustic acts, I decided that I really wanted to try and do this myself, because since the 90s, there'd been so few bands that had actually tried to do something like that, this acoustic neoclassical music, which had these kind of very dark woodland atmospheres to them. And I really just wanted to have a go at doing it myself. I was between bands at the time, so I just picked up an acoustic guitar and started writing some stuff along those lines. I'd also, you know, for the last couple of years since then, I'd really started to explore my heathen faith. Mm-hmm. And this was a way for me to write lyrically something overtly heathen. And put it into the lyrics for a new project. So that's how Wolkensmann came about. And really the whole point of the project has been, you know, kind of like how we were saying that, you know, academic books can feel very sterile, whereas a fictional book which portrays life in heathen times, which really brings it to life, has a lot more power. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was trying to do musically, to kind of bring heathenism to life in an artistic way, as opposed to an academic one.
That's so you're always like you using your own magic, you know, using your music as magic to bring heathenry to life for people.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So I told you this. I'll be completely honest. I am not an atmospheric guy. I am a very straight up. I grew up listening to American metal, Pantera, Slayer, Ronnie James Dio. Iron Maiden's not American. Iron Maiden is English, but I listen, you know, a lot of English new wave of British heavy metal bands.
Well, you know, the very first metal song I ever heard was Cemetery Gates by Pantera.
That's one of the best songs ever.
It is one of the greatest metal songs ever written. Yeah, for sure.
I saw Pantera Reinventing the Steel tour in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that was like, I don't really play much music anymore because I got three kids and I'm, you know, very busy with everything, but I played guitar and played in bands for a long time, and when I saw Pantera in Pittsburgh Reinventing the Steel tour and I saw Dime, I'm sure everybody has seen the videos of the Pantera live, people that are metal fans, and the whole band goes off and Dime just shreds and like does all this stuff. And he just captivates this entire packed arena of people with his shreds. And I'm standing there, and like I was in front row, but we were up pretty far. We had some pretty good seats. And I'm like looking up at this guy, and he's just like this wizard or something. And it was just so captivating. I was like, this is what I want to do. This is incredible. Like the way that he, you know, he used to do this thing. He would just bend the string and go, and he would just raise his hand. And people would start moshing to that. And I was like, the kind of power that this guy wields just with his guitar is incredible. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And I just got, so I've always just been a big fan of that very straightforward thrash, speed metal, you know, power metal, American style power metal. And so I've never really, the Norwegian stuff, like there's a few bands that I liked, like I like, you know, real fans of Norwegian black metal are going to probably get on me, but like my favorite one is like Immortal. I like Immortal. I like Dissection. I like, I'm not really, really big into the black metal stuff, but I like a lot of the sounds, right? I like a lot. You said a word there. You said thick. There's this like very thick, kind of dense feel to the entirety of the sound of a lot of black metal. You have the bar chords going. It has this like big sound to it, right? And a lot of times there's almost like this like synthy kind of thing, which I never got into synth music either. I grew up listening to, rock and roll music, Fog Hat and Deep Purple and, stuff like that. And then later on I got into, heavier stuff. So I never like really got into synth music. Synth music was kind of weird to me because growing up in Pennsylvania, everybody either listened to heavy metal, rock, polka, or country. There's nothing else. So we didn't have any electronic stuff. I was never exposed to it. So lot of this stuff just never really clicked for me. It's not that I dislike it. It's not my natural state, right? But when I was, and I told you this, when I was listening to your album, the Fire in the White Stone, I don't know what the tracks are called, but there's one point where the guitar kind of tapers out, it like fades out, and you go into this like really thick, like a synthy kind of sound. I don't know what you use to make that sound, but at the time I was writing something. I was working on I have a tabletop RPG that I'm writing, and I was at this part that I had such horrible writer's block. I kept reading the same paragraph over and over again, probably like 100 times, like for an hour. Probably felt like hours. And I was listening to that song on your album, and when that sound came about, something in my brain clicked and it sparked, and I started writing again. So I don't know like what it was, but that little thing that you put into your album sparked some creative essence in me, and it was cool. It's a cool album, even for somebody like me that likes Slayer all the time.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
So,
honestly, I do.
Go ahead, Andre.
No, I just have to say that, I will personally admit, I was not overly familiar, at all with your music until a few days ago. But after having listened to it, I find it really nice. It's very pleasant, the best way I can explain it. I'm not the kind of music or metal whiz that Dave, of course, is. I guess I could be considered more of a casual in that regard. But honestly, your music is like right up my alley in terms of the sounds I like.
Well, thank you, Andre.
Yeah, and not to get in kissing your butt too much, but I think that Vulcan's been really captures the heathen feel a lot better than some of the other, I guess you could say, neo-folk bands out there, which feel a little forced and But I don't want to be out. I'm not going to let my bias get in and try to get people not to do it, because it is an important genre for us as a faith and stuff like that. But what I really wanted to ask, I wanted to ask you some musician stuff. You are a multi-talented guy. You don't just play guitar. You also sing. What all instruments do you play, and what all instruments have you incorporated, and have you gotten more instruments and sounds into your sound as time went on?
I'm not really that multi-talented instrumentally. I play guitar, and I've taught myself to sing. I mean, I was always just a guitarist. When I originally started Walkensman, I wanted to find a singer to do the vocals, and I was just going to write the music on guitar, and we'd put it together, and I'd form like a band, which is why it's called Walkensmen, because originally the idea was that it was going to be a band. But I couldn't find anyone who was as passionate about the kind of specific vision I had for the music, who lived close to me, who could work with me on it. Yeah. So in the end, I just thought, well, I'm just making a demo for my own amusement. So I'll just have a go at singing. I'm not tone deaf, so I'm sure I can do a good enough job. And it was okay. Like on the demo, my vocals are a bit kind of rough around the edges, but they're okay. But then when I was talked into, kind of encouraged to write a full length album, which became Songs from the Fergan, I decided that I should really make an effort to become a singer. So I started taking vocal coaching. I guess now I consider myself a guitarist and a singer. I can't really play anything other than that. I can play bass guitar. I've played bass guitar in bands before. I've played bass on some Walkensman stuff. I'm pretty good with you know, programming stuff, like programming synth parts. I understand how music works and how harmonies work. So all of the Walkinsmith stuff is kind of, I guess you could say, designed by me, but then I'll outsource the parts to proper musicians. Like, for example, I'll write some cello lines for the songs, and then I'll contact my favorite cello player and say to her, look, can you record on the album for me? And these are the parts you need to play. And she'll do it 10 times better than you know, the kind of virtual parts that I've programmed will sound. So, yeah, I kind of, I'm not a multi-instrumentalist, but I do know how I want a variety of instruments to sound, and I know how they should sound. So, you know, I just kind of build everything up and in the best way that I can, and then when it comes to the final recording, then I gather in the kind of real musicians to play. Like, for example, the flute parts on my albums were actually played by, and I noticed, Dave, that you posted on your Telegram channel a song by Visigoth.
Yeah,
the other day.
I love that song.
Yeah, I mean, they're a brilliant band, but Jake from Visigoth is a good friend of mine, and he's a really great flute player. So he played flute on the Walkinsmith songs for me, and, you know, things like that. So I just kind of, I call in favors from people I know who play other instruments which I don't play.
That's very cool, man. It gives your albums a very full feel. It's, you know, it's good stuff, man. Yeah, that Visigoth, that song Mammoth Rider, when I found that song, I've been finally listening to the rest of that album. That Mammoth Rider song, I listened to that literally like for an entire day, like on repeat. I'm a crazy person. I get obsessed with like songs, or like sometimes I get obsessed with like song parts, and I'll like replay the song part like 10 times in a row. I'm a crazy person. But I'm also a guitar player. So I wanted to ask you some guitar stuff. Can you give us your top five favorite guitar players?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Number one, definitely Ritchie Blackmore.
All right.
Yeah. Number two. Do you know what I mean? This I'll probably catch some flack for this, but this is my like my inner kind of 10-year-old coming out. Probably Richie Sambora, because I was one of the first kind of rock bands that I got into was Bon Jovi, and I still think that Richie Sambora had a really great knack for writing really kind of memorable guitar solos, really tasteful, memorable guitar solos. Yeah, I mean, even though I wouldn't consider myself an enormous Pantera fan, I'd probably put that Dimebag in there just because his playing was just, it was just out of this world. And who else? You know what? I actually made it because I knew you were going to ask me some questions about favorite bands and stuff. So I've made a list of stuff. So I'm just going to reference some stuff here. Yeah, I don't know. I could say, I could say in terms of tone, specifically in terms of the guitar tone, Brian May from Queen. I think that guitar tone is just, it's so unique and iconic, and really influenced a lot of people. Other than that, maybe George Lynch, from Dokken. Great guitar player. I mean, there are there's so many I could name. You know,
that's a good list,
I'm kind of going back to.
You caught me off guard with Jovi's guitar player. I did not think you were going to say that. That is...
Yeah.
I'm from...
Do you know what?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go on. I was going to say, I will admit that probably the reason that I became a guitarist in the first place was because of Bon Jovi. You know, because, I mean, I was 10 years old, you know, and this was my first introduction to rock music. And, you know, this was about the time that, like, I think this was about the time they released the album Keep the Faith. And they had that video where Richie Sambora was on top of, like, a mountain playing a Strat. I was like, yeah, you know.
Well, I'm from Eastern Pennsylvania. And yeah. Bon, Bon Jovi himself, I can't remember if he's from Philadelphia or if he's from South Jersey, but he is from my area. So every like person, especially women, if you meet a woman that is over 35, they all just still love Bon Jovi. He is the man out here. And there's like this low key football league. It's like an amateur football league called the Arena Football League, and they play an arena, and it's like 5-on-5. It's like really cheap, low rent American football. And Bon Jovi owns a team called the Philadelphia Soul. So if you get season tickets for Philadelphia Soul, you get to see Bon Jovi concerts for free. So if you ever want to come over and see Bon Jovi, just get the season passes for Philadelphia Soul, which are like, you know, $30.
Well, considering they had an album called New Jersey, I'm assuming they're from New Jersey.
Yeah, I believe he's from South Jersey. But, that's a good list. Richie Blackmore, I love Richie Blackmore. I absolutely love
him. Yeah.
I know he's a jerk and he's, like, not a good person and all that. But Rainbow was absolutely brilliant. Deep Purple, I don't even need to say anything. You know, Machine Head is one of the greatest rock and roll heavy metal albums of all time. The entire album, front to back, is just full of bangers. Lazy, you obviously Smoke on the Water. Everybody knows that. Maybe I'm a Leo. That album absolutely rules. You know, and then he's got this project now, Richie Blackmore's Night or whatever that is, where he does kind of like medieval music stuff. That's great too.
It's great. And like you, I've got three children, and it's the kind of music that I've been able to get them into. You know, they love Blackmore's Night. When my eldest was very, very young, unfortunately, she was too young to come with us, but my wife and I went to see Blackmore's Night play just because I wanted to see Blackmore perform. Mm-hmm. And luckily, a few years later, he reunited because he was the only member, but he brought Rainbow back to the stage, so I got to see, like, you know, him perform Rainbow songs then, which was awesome. But he's kind of a dick, I guess, but you know, you want that from people like him in a sense. He's always played by his own rules, and he's like criminally underappreciated in terms of his influence as well.
Yes. We always hear about Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and like all this stuff. Richie Blackmore is in my opinion, of that era, is top three most underrated guitar players of that era. He was absolutely incredible. The music that he wrote changed the game. It really, really did.
So, absolutely.
I'm just going to throw out my top five off the top of my head. I got Dime. Dime, of course. I have Malmsteen. I would put Malmsteen on there. I would put Richie Blackmore in there too. I would put Iommi, and I would put I would put Leslie West from Mountain. That would be my top five.
Okay, you know, I'm not familiar with Mountain, but all the others I agree with.
Mountain did Mississippi Queen.
I'm terrible with song titles. Maybe I'd know it if I heard it.
Yeah, they were a band in the 60s that were around. They actually played at Woodstock. They were actually produced by, their bass player was Felix Pappalardi, who produced Cream. So they were they were in the game. They were pretty popular.
Even before Cream's time. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
So we
got another question in.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Phil asks, this is for Dave or Dan. Do you have any advice with regards to Galder? I make offerings, but I'd like to introduce Galder into my life.
I can answer that one. I believe that the most, and this is just my own kind of gut instinct, which has taught me this, but I believe that the most important part of the rune when you're singing Galder is the Z, because it's that vibration that, you know, when you're talking about the Proto-Germanic runes, Algiz and Manas and things. It's that Z on the end. So when I perform Galder myself, I always really overemphasize the Z at the end, and I really try and kind of draw that, the vibration that comes from that zzz in kind of within myself. And I find that that helps me kind of alter my kind of state of consciousness slightly.
Yeah, vibration, it's certainly, you know, an important thing. We see that it's across the board with Indo-European vocal practices is vibration. They do the throat singing. They do the there's techniques where you scrunch your throat and you create the vibration in your head and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. My practice of Galdr is not based on runes. I don't really use runes. I use stanzas from the Poetic Edda. So I actually have a full like system, and it's very much akin to maybe like a Vedic mantra with the notation system. However, it's I have some videos talking about Galdr, so if anybody's interested in you know how I do Galdr, they can go check that out. I have quite a few Galdrs that I've put out to the public that people can check out. I'm eventually going to put out a book, and we're going to do maybe an album or something at some point. But people can check that out. So that's about it. I would, if you want just something basic, go check out my video introduction to the Norse practice of pagan, whatever it is, and then check out, I have two on there. I have the Alu chant, and I have Osnetmer Odin. I believe I have Bithium Heria Father Ihigum Sitya Galdr, and you could use those. And I put a drone. I use drone in B flat, just because that's the one that's kind of in tune with the Schumann resonance. So that's my take on it. But yeah, you can check out that kind of stuff. Mr. Dan, I wanted to ask you about singers, since now that you are in the arena of singers, who are some singers that you have really liked, or maybe just frontmen in general that have really influenced you with your music, or maybe if a top five of them, if you'd like.
I mean, there's definitely a kind of a division between those who've influenced me for Walkensman and those who've influenced who I'm just kind of in admiration of as a music fan. I mean, for Walkensman, I've definitely been influenced by Quorthon from Bathory. Even though he's, you know, he's not considered to have a technically great voice, I just think that the way that he delivers is so authentic and honest. I always looked up to the way that he delivered vocally. I'm a big fan of Dead Can Dance. So Brendan Perry from Dead Can Dance is a big influence on me. And actually the re-release of my demo has got a cover of a Dead Can Dance song on it, where I did my best to sing one of his songs, which was no mean feat, because he's a great singer. You know, he's kind of like got this kind of sort of gothic Frank Sinatra vibe going on. Him for sure. Then Garm from Ulva. As I said, Ulva, the Norwegian black metal band, he's their second album, Kveldsanger, with his very kind of choral, ethereal vocals, was always a very big influence on me. Those are some examples of guys that have influenced me in terms of Walkensman. In terms of my favorite singers, definitely Ronnie James Dio, number one.
Hell yeah.
Undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, he's got to be the greatest metal singer of all time.
I cried when he died. I was gonna say that.
Yeah, I don't often get sad when celebrities die, because unless you've got a personal relationship with them, I don't really see why you would. But that was upsetting, because I knew people who worked in the music industry who had met him through putting on festivals and things. And apparently he was always a gentleman, always very, very cool to people, you know, gave people tips, that said thank you to people, you know, was just a obviously very confident guy because of everything he had achieved. But he was... you know, he was modest with it, and he was, you know, he was very cool to people. So yeah, absolutely, deserving of his legendary godlike status, Ronnie James Dio. Who else? Glenn Danzig. Glenn Danzig for sure. Yeah. I mean, I grew up a big Misfits fan. You know, you know, after I kind of been introduced to, you know, stuff like Bon Jovi and that, then I quickly found my way to stuff like the Misfits and Danzig and things. So yeah, I mean, he's one of my favorites for sure. Who else? The guy from, I don't know if you're familiar, Dave, with a band called Lost Horizon from Sweden. They're kind of like some people consider them power metal, but it was more kind of like traditional metal. And the guy, his name's Daniel Hyman. Absolutely incredible voice. I mean, his range is phenomenal. Incredible. I mean, from the lowest to the highest notes, just perfect. Great singer. David DeFay from Virgin Steel. Big fan of Virgin Steel. I don't know if you're familiar with them, Dave.
I am.
You must be,
Virgin
surely.
Steel, yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had an album called guys. Age of Consent, right? Age of Consent.
Yeah, they did, yeah. Yeah. Back when that was acceptable. Yeah. David Coverdale, I'll name him. Yeah. Great
singer.
Of course,
Whitesnake, yeah.
I'm pretty old school, like in my tastes, really. There's not many too many kind of modern singers that I really like. It's generally bands from the 80s that I listen to the most. Those guys. I'm sure I'm going to think of, like, as soon as this show finishes, I'm going to think of a load of singers and guitarists that I really admire that I could have named. But yeah, that will do for now.
We've got a question for you, Dan.
Okay.
Stephen Bader asks, "Hey Dan, I believe there are songs in your discography that were inspired by the countryside in the UK. Where are your favorite places to visit for inspiration?"
Okay, yeah. I don't think there's any specific kind of landscapes that have inspired songs of mine. It's just kind of general feels, like, you know, if you're walking in the woods in autumn, or if you're you know, walking some rolling hills in spring or something like that. It's not in any specific place. But I did write an entire song that was inspired by something which happened to me at Wayland Smithy, which is an old Neolithic burial mound in, I think it's just on the border of Wiltshire and Oxfordshire in the south of England. And it's a very, very kind of, spiritually powerful place. And after the arrival of the Germanic tribes, they renamed it Wayland Smithy after the Germanic god Wayland. And that's a really important place. And, we probably don't have time to go into it, but I had a very mystical experience which happened to me there, which I then went on to write a song about. So yeah, that's an important place. There's not any specific places. I'm inspired by kind of the general mood of places, but not necessarily a specific place. So whether it be woodland or meadows or coastline or something like that, that's what inspires me in a more kind of general sense. And there is an atmosphere which is pervasive throughout the British Isles, which I've kind of tried to tap into and kind of capture in musical form, I guess. I mean, my wife and I, we love going around and visiting Neolithic sites, standing stones and stone circles and things. We've got a couple of books which we take with us on journeys and things, and we stop at these places, and all of them kind of combine to inspire me, because they're a very potent reminder that paganism was very much alive and kicking on the land upon which I walk, at one point in time, you know, that my ancestors did actually believe these things, which people like us, here believe now, and are kind of made to feel a bit kind of odd for believing. But there was a point in time when it wasn't odd in any sense. It was absolutely the way that everyone viewed the world. And I love visiting places which remind me of that.
Very cool. All right, Mr. Dan, we are starting to go over an hour. I know it's pretty late there, so unfortunately we are going to have to shut it down for this evening. But if you're going to come back and do a part two and yak about all our favorite bands and all our favorite singers and all this kind of stuff, or tell us about the Furigan or whatever you'd like, you are always more than welcome to come back onto the bog. So before we do our closeout stuff, what can folks expect moving forward from Vulcansman? Is there anything that you would like to plug?
The only thing I'll plug is that I have a Telegram, Odyssey, and YouTube channel called The Fergan, which is it's a way for me to express my views and concerns on things other than music. Mm-hmm. This is an endeavor which I began since everything that's happened in the last year across the world with the whole kind of COVID scam. So that's taken a lot of my focus recently. So if anyone's interested in my views on that kind of thing, then please, yeah, look up The Fergan. That's Fyrgen. And that's Fergan is an old English word meaning wooded hilltop or wooded mountaintop. And yeah, I got that name from the first album, which is my first Walkinsman album, which was called Songs from the Fergan. So I just, you know, I decided to name my channel Fergan. But any of you that don't want to know my views on anything other than music, then please don't follow it, because I don't expect everyone who likes my music to want to know my philosophies on other things. But yeah, I'm pretty focused on that. As for Walkinsman, I have to admit that I've not been hugely inspired to write anything for a while. Inspiration hasn't taken me yet, but the last album that I released, I wrote a whole short story to accompany the album. And it's a concept album. So the whole project that was involved in making Fire in the White Stone was an enormous one. I mean, it was like a year and a half of solid kind of dedication and then the recording process and the mixing process. And anyone who's made a record knows how intense that can be. So I'm not in a hurry to kind of jump back into that kind of situation again at the moment. And I'm working on a couple of other musical things at the moment. I'm actually more likely to be releasing metal in the near future, excuse me, than I am any more neo-folk stuff. But that said, I'm not putting an end to Walkinsman in any sense. It's just having a rest at the moment. So as soon as inspiration hits me again, then there'll be something more. It won't be this year for sure. So maybe next year onwards, I'll be able to, you know, warn people about some upcoming Walkinsman stuff.
And one more quick question. Cause I'm a creative guy too.
Sure.
Do you feel that, and I feel this is a very Odinic thing. This is like the Fuhrer Poeticus, the fury of poetry and everything. Do you feel that you go into like these almost borderline unhealthy obsessions with your creations, and then afterwards you're completely burnt out?
Absolutely, yeah, completely. It must be a thing. Like, I mean, I've got, you know, I work a day job. I've got three children. I've got a wife and a household to keep and stuff. So when I get to the point of making an album, the only way I can do it is by, staying up really late, like several nights a week. You know, I'll like when my wife goes to bed, then, you know, I'll jump on the computer, open up my music software, and I'll start working and pick up the guitar and write lyrics and things. And that's the only time. So I'll go through a process of, you know, for months on end where I'll be sleeping very little, and I'll be, you know, the moment I wake up, I'm thinking about what I worked on the night before and what I went to, when I go to sleep, I'm thinking about the structures of the songs, and throughout the day I'm thinking about lyrics, and when I'm walking the dog, I'm thinking, yeah. So it's very, very intense for the time that I am working on it. And it's not really kind of a fun experience. It's just something that I know I need to do. I guess it's probably the same with you, Dave. It's just like, you know, when you've got a bee in your bonnet, when you've got a kind of, you know, something that needs to come out of you, then you just need to go through that kind of process of labor, and you know that it's not going to be necessarily an enjoyable experience, and that it's going to be a stressful one, but that you'll feel better for having done it when it's over.
Yeah, it's a crazy person thing. It really is. It's up late, man. My last obsession has been this tabletop game that I've been working on, because I have, you know, I was really starting to get depressed. I've always loved tabletop games, and I always wanted to make one. I've been kind of writing notes and stuff my whole life, dude. And I'm like, I have time right now. I'm going to do this. And I got so obsessed, man. I was staying up late. It was getting bad. Like, I was like, I wrote like 35,000 words in a week, probably more that I just got rid of. And my kinsman came over one time. I completely forgot he was coming over. He comes over. I'm like in my sweatpants, my shirt. I'm like, my hair's all nuts. He's like, you look insane. You have bags under your eyes. You literally look like a crazy person. You haven't been sleeping, have you? I was like, no, I haven't been sleeping at all. But it's a necessary thing. It's like the part of the process.
Yeah.
I'm sure every creative person had this. It's a very Odinic thing. You go into the darkness and you go through this weird obsession with this thing. You become fixated. You can't stop thinking about it. Every waking moment, it's in the back of your mind. It gnaws at you until it's done. Yeah. And then afterwards, you're completely burnt out. You're like, I don't even want to talk about this right now. You know what I mean? So it's I think it's just a creative person thing.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, I often say this, in my opinion, creation is the greatest act of worship, because your ancestors and your gods, they bestowed you with these talents and these skills. Everyone has them to varying degrees. Everyone has different skills and different strengths and things. But if you're not using what you were given to the maximum effect, then I personally feel like you're doing a disservice to your gods and your ancestors and what they gave you. So when I embark on a project, I want to do it with the utmost kind of effort and success, and to use everything that I have, put everything I have into it, because unless I do that, I don't feel like I've honored the gods and the ancestors.
Yeah, it's I feel that it's a gift. It's like a gift that the gods are giving. And here's what separates the gods from the Jotun or the Hrimthursar or any of the other beings. The gods have the gift of creation. They create things. The Jotun don't necessarily create things. The gods create things. They created us. They literally sired us. So when we look at we are the children of the gods. And if the gods are creators and we want to be like our divine parents, we ourselves should invoke that creative essence as well. So that's my take on it, and I really agree with that. And this has been a wonderful conversation, Mr. Dan. And like I said, anytime that you want to come back on, let me know, and we'll get it figured out. And I will share the Furgan thing on my Telegram so everybody sees it, so everybody can go over there and subscribe to him there. But many blessings and many hails to you, Mr. Dan, and to all the Bog Lords out there, many hails and many blessings. Thank you, every single one of you, for tuning in tonight. If you like us, you support the Bog, you want to help us keep the lights on, make sure to go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, so you can get the RSS feed to get audio of this show and every other show to listen to in your car, on your commutes, at gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/thebog. If you want to support us another way, you can go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and buy some sweet merch. Man, summer's coming. Get yourself a t-shirt. Get yourself a muscle shirt. Get yourself an apron so you can sit at the grill and fire up some stuff for your kinsmen. And if you want to support a friend of ours, make sure you go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check that out. Man, I'm telling you, authentic Vedic astrology. It is so cool, man. It is so cool. It'll blow your mind. I got a reading. Yeah, it really blew my mind. You guys can check out our interviews with Neil John from Iron Age Jodish that were a few weeks ago. So just check out The Bog featuring Neil John, Iron Age Jodish. You're going to absolutely love it. But go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check it out. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. Tell them Big Dave sent you. So like always, many hails, many blessings to each and every one of you. I'll see you guys next week, Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on The Bog. I'll see you guys later.